At the hairdresser, in the doctor's office, and on the newsstands, for decades, women's magazines were there. The glossy pages of Redbook and Shape and Glamour for women to skim and in some cases swear by. Growing up, these magazines featured women that didn't exactly look like me, with clothes and beauty products that I really couldn't afford, but they gave a voice to issues that women cared about, and often they were also written by women journalists. Many of you, our listeners, have similar stories to share.
Regarding women's magazines, they used to make me feel like a failure, despite the fact that I'm 5'6 and a half and weigh about 132 pounds. Now, I simply ignore them. My name is Mary. I live in suburban Philadelphia.
I love them. I love all the new products that they represent, the clothing, the women wearing new trendy things, new ideas to make my life simple.
This is Nancy in Dallas. I got a lot of good information from women's magazines over the decades. Now that they're digital, I don't read them anymore.
What Nancy brings up is important for some of us. In a changing media landscape, women's magazines are changing as well. And January is the last month that readers will be able to buy a print copy of Glamour magazine. That's after more than 80 years in publication. Teen Vogue, Redbook, and others have already shifted to digital-only formats, and titles like Lucky and Ladies Home Journal have even folded in recent years. So what does this mean for women readers of all ages who've relied on these glossies for so long? Well, I've got two women with me now who know a thing or two about this industry. Samita Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue. Thanks for joining us, Samita.
Thanks for having me.
And Vanessa DeLuca, who was the editor-in-chief of Essence from 2013 to 2018. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you.
So I cannot tell you, well, I have told you how excited I am to have both of you here, goddesses of print glossy magazines. Let's start with the news about Glamour. I'm actually stunned. I saw it go through this shift. It got like a new font and it started looking really different. And now all of a sudden, it's gone, Vanessa, or it will be gone. You started at Glamour. What was Glamour like back in the day?
Well, back in the day when I was there with Ruth Whitney, it was like a bastion of women's journalism. You know, all kinds of amazing voices were featured. The fact that, you know, Ruth Whitney had the foresight to cover politics long before a lot of other publications were doing it. I think it was really a highlight of the magazine world at a certain time.
Do you think it served a role for women specifically? Like, was there something that Glamour did that other magazines maybe weren't doing?
Well, I think that it looked at women holistically, right? It wasn't just fashion and beauty. There was politics. There was community issues. There was relationships. There were money, finances. It really looked at women's lives through a very informed lens, not catering or speaking down to women, but actually telling them the things that they should know or they should care about, in addition to the things that they did care about.
So, Samita, you're at the top of this, little magazine called Teen Vogue, which has suddenly now become like the wokest of woke. But Teen Vogue made a similar transition that one of our callers was talking about, now going to digital only. Can you explain for us what was behind that decision?
Yeah, and just to kind of contextualize this, this was prior to my arriving a few months before at Teen Vogue. And, you know, part of this transition was really based on where Gen Z gets their news. And they don't really go to the store and pick up a magazine, right? Or they're not necessarily, you know, they might see it at the doctor's office, but it's not really the target audience, right? And millennials and younger, Gen Z, I would say, you know, they really get their news on Instagram.
So right? Who are Gen Z? Because I think everybody is now a millennial. Nobody knows. There's old millennials, there's young. Like, who is Gen Z first?
Gen Z is technically, I think, under 22.
Okay, got it. Okay.
So today's high school students.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they are not as likely to pick up a magazine in the same way, right? Maybe a collector's issue they might be interested in or something that has a special value or, you know, something like that. But in general, they're getting their news from their phone. And, you know, I think the industry is kind of reflecting that transition.
So I want to ask both of you, other than like the obvious, which is age, like how has the demographic changed for women's magazines, or has the demographic changed? I mean, are teen girls still going to be teen girls and young, you know, older teenage? Like, what's exactly, is it a similar audience or a different audience? Vanessa?
I mean, I think that the audience is the same and some of the concerns and issues are the same. It's just how they are digesting that information is totally different. So you, as, you know, as someone who's in media, you have to be flexible. You have to be multi-platform. You have to be available wherever he is, because if you're not, then you're going to lose that audience. But I definitely think that the audience still cares about a lot of these issues. If they didn't, they wouldn't be engaging at all.
And Samita, you guys have also, like I said, you're now like, I mean, no joke, Teen Vogue is considered super woke, super informative. Like, is that was a big editorial shift too.
It was a big editorial shift. And I would say, you know, it's not the audience, whether it's changed or not. I think that audiences have much higher standards about what they're going to see in the media. And young people especially, they want to see authentic portrayals, inclusive portrayals of their own lives and the stories that impact their lives. And that, you know, we have had to respond to that pressure, I think. And I believe it's a good pressure because it's further democratizing the types of images we're seeing in magazines and the types of stories that we're covering. To Vanessa's point, I actually think a lot of women's magazines have been doing that work without getting a lot of the credit. But what's often overshadowed that work is these kind of toxic visions of femininity that have perpetuated and kind of dominated the women's marketplace. And I don't actually blame the women's magazines in particular for that. I think that that's a market issue. I think that's an advertiser issue. And I think it's, you know, people trying to figure out funding models and things like that. So I do think that young people are just, they're more woke about this stuff, right? They don't want to see just, you know, kind of cisgender, you know, hetero, thin, white models on the cover of their magazines.
I remember I read these magazines like any other young girl did, you know, 17 and YM and all that, except I was a brown girl with a big nose and broad lips and never saw myself. And then one day my mother bought a magazine named Sassy and said, look, I don't know what this is. Here's a cover with a girl that has a nose that looks like you. That was life-changing for me. I became a subscriber right after that. Where are we today when it comes to women that look like the rest of us in magazines?
Yeah. So I was also a sassy girl. And
thank you.
One of the most exciting things about working in magazines today is the hope and kind of, I think, the interest for a platform like Sassy Again, where, you know, kind of like non-mainstream voices are heard and kind of pick, you know, images of women that we can relate to. And, you know, I think the marketplace has fractured so much. I think there are so many different places to get the types of media you want. But I actually think we are a little early in celebrating how much the industry has actually shifted in terms of relying on certain, you know, certain visions of beauty and certain kind of stereotypical ideas of what it looks like to be a woman. I mean, I think if you look at all the kind of most famous supermodels, they're still extremely skinny. They, you know, have a specific type of nose, specific type of hair. And while we are seeing more diverse images, often you have to go out and find them yourself. You have to be interested. Instagram, Tumblr, you know, and it's exciting to be Teen Vogue. We are very conscientious about that and kind of incorporating and elevating those voices. And I'd love to see more magazines doing that.
Vanessa, what about your experience in essence with that? And this preeminent magazine for Black women in particular?
No, we know that representation matters, and the way that representation shows up also matters. So we're talking about different hair textures, different skin tones, different ways of dressing, different ways of accessorizing, you know, just that personal style piece that you didn't necessarily see all the time in more of the mainstream publications. I mean, if at all, there would be maybe one image of a woman with curly hair, quote unquote curly hair.
And that's about as far as it went.
And that is really about as far as it went. So we understood at Essence how deeply important it was to make sure that we were hitting on all of the notes, because it matters. People want to be seen. People want to know that there is that their look, their style is being acknowledged and being celebrated, actually.
Are Black women looking for something specific in media that you think they're not getting today, particularly when it comes to magazines and this type of content?
I think it's a depth of understanding. You know, it's not enough to say this lipstick shade is great for this particular tone of brown, right? It's more an deeper understanding of how diverse we are, how diverse we truly are, and then delivering that message in a way that speaks to who we are as Black women. That has always been, I have felt, a challenge in mainstream publications. It's like they're paying lip service, literally, to what they think will appeal to a specific audience, but they're not necessarily going deeper and talking about some of the deeper issues that are surrounding how we feel about how we look and how society feels about how we look.
I think one of the things that comes up in that, and Samita, you're nodding your head, is also the issue of feminism, right? Which is really easy to talk about today. I remember a dark time in the 90s when this was considered the other F word. Nobody wanted to say it. Nobody wanted to claim it. But today we can have this conversation about feminism. Are women's magazines tasked with some feminist message today that they weren't in the past, do you think?
Absolutely. I do think that there is an external pressure because most young women identify as feminist now. And, you know, Tenzina, you know, my background really does come from feminist media. And, you know, I was at Feministing for a very long time. And our interest and often our task was to hold mainstream media accountable for the way, not just how they were representing women, but how they were representing actual feminists, right? And I do think we're kind of at this tipping point. I mean, I think ever since Beyonce got on stage and claimed feminism, it became accessible to a broader audience, which is a good thing. That's what we want, right? And I do think that that pressure that's now put on magazines, that's good. That's only going to bring us stronger stories. It's only going to increase our understanding and I think spread, you know, feminism's message to a broader audience.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the idea that there are voices out there that should be heard, that are to be discovered, that are representing different points of view, that's a critical piece of pushing the culture forward, right? So it's so exciting to see that some of these more mainstream publications are mainstream brands are looking for those, seeking out those voices, giving them a platform on which to be heard. I wish they would do more of it, a lot more of it. I wish they would dig even deeper, you know, just beyond just kind of like the surface people that you hear about or have a book out or, I mean, really dig deep into some of these, you know, these nether regions of consciousness and bring those voices to the table. That would be even more exciting.
There's one other thing that women's magazines were known for back in the day, and I'm going to read an excerpt here from a 1955 edition of Good Housekeeping. The article was titled, or headlined, The Good Wife's Guide, just so we're all aware. I know, eyeballs rolling in back of heads. Ready, ladies, it reads, have dinner ready. Touch up your makeup and don't complain if he's late home for dinner or even if he stays out all night. This is the 1955, ladies. Now, obviously, we've evolved somewhat, some would say, since then. But you can still pick up some magazines and find, you know, 57 ways to keep your man happy. I don't know. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? I mean, do we all have to have feminist women's magazines now? Or can we, is there a room for The Good Wife's Guide or The Good GF's Guide or whatever?
I mean, I think it's okay as long as there's balance. Well, I'm not okay with that article. Let's be clear. that I'm not okay with. That's crazy. But I do think that there's, you know, that just being a feminist doesn't mean that you don't embrace looking good and feeling good about yourself and empowering yourself in that way. It doesn't mean that at all. And I think we just have to make sure that there's enough balance there so that you're not putting emphasis on the superficial and, you know, and what's in front of you.
Samita, your thoughts on that?
I think there's a piece of this that's really about meeting the audience where they're at, right? And you know, whether I agree or disagree, the reality is there's a percentage of women that do want information like that, right? And we kind of have to meet them where they are. And I do think it's important, you know, and something that I've really learned over the years is you don't want to alienate women based on certain choices. That doesn't mean you have to agree with everything they say. And I'm certainly not advocating for choice feminism or anything like that. But I do think that the reality is, you know, especially with teen girls, they have certain values and ideas about sex or about courtship. And who are we to kind of judge that? I think it's about giving them the information they need to make the decisions that are best for them.
Samita Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue, and Vanessa DeLuca was the editor-in-chief of Essence from 2013 to 2018. She's now the founder of TheEditorInChief.com, a new lifestyle platform. Thank you both for being with me.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
And thanks so much for listening to our show today. You can tweet us with your thoughts about pretty much anything at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.